This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to learn about a unique corner of World War II history. 75 years ago this week, the Battle of Okinawa was finally nearing its end. Fighting continued in the Philippines as well. And in China, a 19-year-old frogman named Don Hardenbrook had already spent 3 months with a secret unit called Sako. We're going to rejoin his story a little prior to that in Fort Pierce, Florida, where if you visit today, you'll find the National Navy UDT SEAL Museum, which preserves the history of the early pioneers of that calling, like Don, and of course all who have followed since.
We got through in Florida with our training. We could either take money for going to Long Beach, California, or we could take a train ride, and they'd take us all the way there. And so anytime I got the choice, I would take the money, and then I would hitchhike. By the time I got there, I still had the money, and I was there, and the other guys didn't have any money. And hitchhiking from Florida to Long Beach, California was kind of fun. Took me about 4.5 days.
I'm sure you met some interesting folks along the way, and I'm sure you were in uniform, huh?
Yeah, everybody would pick up people that were in uniform, but I got lucky. I had a girlfriend whose dad was the mayor of the town where we trained in Fort Pierce, Florida, and she made arrangements through him to get me on an Army Air Corps airplane, take me all the way to Georgia or someplace out there. I think it was in Georgia, and so I just had to hitchhike from Georgia to California. So that wasn't too bad. 2,000 miles or so.
Child's play. So what happened next? Once you got to California, where did you go from there?
Well, we got on a ship very soon that the USS Lejeune was on her maiden voyage, and we went to Hawaii, and then we headed around to India, just out of Calcutta.
And this is in late 1944?
Yes. And it was interesting, when we got fairly close to India, I was up on the bridge and helping steer the ship from time to time. And we got a call from the bow that there was a submarine or there was a torpedo coming. And so we went on alert, of course, and the old man, the captain, said, let's hold up on that. And so they called up on the bridge and asked the guy if there were still torpedoes coming. And he said, yeah, they're coming from both sides. Well, some of those water down there in the South Pacific, just in different places, have a tremendous amount of phosphorus in the water. And these wonderful dolphins love to run with the ship and at the bow. And they were just circling and coming right at the bow, coming around and coming right at the bow. And this poor kid up there just thought we were going to be torpedoed and we'd all be dead in a few minutes. And so the old man, the captain, didn't laugh, but the rest of us did under our breath. And we were glad we weren't the guy up in the bow who was going to really get ripped on for saying that in the middle of the night, you know.
That's a long journey that you're describing. And I'm sure while you had buddies to hang out with and everything, I'm sure you had a lot of time to think about things and to imagine what might be happening next, what you might face. Was it hard to be so far away from home and look out at such an uncertain future?
Well, sometimes. We stopped in Melbourne, in Australia, and every girl there wanted to get married to an American. And so we stopped for one day to refuel and that sort of thing. And we got, I don't know how many guys had a gal on each arm. And I was a little shy. I was still pretty young, and I didn't know much about dating or any of that stuff. And so we did something that probably we shouldn't have done, though. But we needed one more Jeep, we thought. And so some Army guys came up in a Jeep, and all of them got out, which was very unusual. So our commanding officer worked with the captain, and very quickly they had swung over a boom and some straps, and they picked up that Jeep, took it over, put it on deck, dropped it below deck, got out some gray paint, navy gray paint, painted it and put some black lettering on it, and it was a Navy Jeep. The guys came out and there wasn't any Army Jeep left, and so we had our full complement of Jeeps.
And we wonder why the Army-Navy football game gets so heated from time to time. I guess you just liberated it, huh?
Yeah. Well, we needed it, you know, more than they did, so we thought.
When did you first hear this acronym, SOCO, and what can you tell us about its significance?
Well, we heard about it in Florida, and of course, all we could remember was of China was in geography books, and it was kind of interesting because it was way over there, and really nobody was in China but the flying tigers. And so it was just kind of an interesting thought to go over there and be different than 95, 98, 99% of the Navy people. And we considered ourselves different because we were frogmen.
And SOCO stands for?
Sino-American Cooperative Organization. And Sino, of course, is Chinese. And it was a Chinese and American cooperative effort put together by, I think it was FDR and Generalissimo Chiang, and one ranking general, one ranking admiral, and one secretary in the Navy, a lady that was about 6'3" and had a waist that was about 16 inches. Everybody called her Slim. Everybody called her Slim. Everybody knew Slim because she ordered everything for SOCO. She was an amazing person. I never got to meet her, but she's the one that procured all of the stuff for us that we couldn't steal from somebody else. And we had to do that sometimes, too.
Well, I want to hear some of those stories and even hear about how you did interact with General Chiang Kai-shek and even his wife. And the China-Burma-India theater of World War II gets overlooked so often because people think about Europe and they think about the Pacific and all the invasions and the naval battles. What kind of things were you doing in China? And did anyone else know about this, or is this something that was kept under wraps?
I think it was kept under wrap. I was paid twice while I was over there, and you just kind of had to make do. Once you got over there, you were just kind of lost as far as the rest of the world was concerned. And we had one thing to do, and that was to harass the Japanese and keep them from coming up into Kunming and Guiyang and Chongqing. And we had to train Chinese so they knew how to fight with arms. They didn't have any guns. And one of the things that was always kind of interesting, and I didn't go out to bring mine in, is all of us wore a Gurkha knife. It was a kind of a hook knife that comes from India, and the Japanese did not like Gurkha knives because they're very sharp and you could do a lot of damage with them very quickly.
What kinds of combat situations did you find yourself in, and can you give us a sense of what that felt like to be a teenager here in really a secret area of the war, going up against a skilled enemy the way you had to?
I think we just went in to do our job. We knew what we had to do. We had officers that told us when we had officers. Some of the officers were what we called 90-day wonders. They were in college when the war started, so they were college, so they got them in the Navy and the Army Air Corps and Marines, and they made them officers because they were in college, not because they were good officers. But our officer of our group was named Marcunas, and he was a great guy. He was just one of us, and that's why we liked him. But our job was to go in and slow down the Japanese by any means possible from getting the rest of China. We did that several different ways, and one of the ways I guess we did it was by training. We trained just over 70,000 Chinese troops. When we first went there, the Japanese were killing about 3,000 Chinese troops a week. By the time the war was ended, the Chinese were killing 3,000 Japanese a week. So once they got trained, they really did their job. Because of what Japan had done since 1937, they were raised with a insidious hate for the Japanese because of what the Japanese soldiers had done to their livestock, to their women, and to any men that they found also. They just had an extreme hatred for the Japanese.
So you specifically, some of the things you had to do would be to put explosives in strategic positions that might deter the Japanese on roadways, or were you engaged in hand-to-hand combat? A little of everything? What can you tell us about that?
No, we were trained for hand-to-hand combat, but I think I prayed that I'd never have to get into it. In fact, in training, I had a good buddy that his nose bled quickly, and so when we got into training, we had to fight each other, and so we found out with his nose bleeding quickly that if I hit him on the nose, he'd bleed, and then we didn't have to fight anymore. But we learned what they called jiu-jitsu back in those days, and I don't think I was very good at it. And I could handle a knife real well, but hand-to-hand, I don't think I was ever very good at that, but I never had to do it.
What were some of the things that you would have to do on a typical action that you were assigned to?
One time we had to blow up several different places of railroad rail that the Japanese used to bring cargo in and that sort of thing, and we take about a half pound of, they call it, composition 2 C2, and then wrap that over and put in an explosive and pop that, and I just cut the rail quickly. And if you cut the rails neatly, it was hard to see if you were an engineer on the train, so you'd drive over those and then the rails would spread and it would stop the whole train, and maybe sometimes it'd lay them over. So that was one thing we did. And another thing we did was try to take out any Japanese patrols that were looking for us, and we would move quickly from one place to another, and we did it on foot. We had in our base camp, we had one truck and we had one jeep. That was for the officers, and the rest of us all did walking, and so we walked a lot of miles. And when you would hit one patrol one place, then you would immediately start walking so that you'd be 20 or 25 miles away when you hit the next patrol, and then 25 miles away when you hit the next patrol. And so the Japanese would think that we had a lot more people up against them than we did have, because we never had over 2,300 men, as far as Americans were concerned, Marines and Navy. We never had over 2,300 to cover all of China. China's as big as the U.S. of A. And so we did everything on foot, and if you finished up and you were 90 or 150 miles away, well, then you had to walk night and day until you get back to the base and get more explosives and more ammunition, and you'd get a day usually of rest and then start out again. We had a great cook back in the base camp, and so you'd eat half the time and sleep half the time and then leave again.
I was going to say, it sounds pretty exhausting to me. What would you say kept you going? Because I imagine that can really drain you both physically and mentally and emotionally. What kept you focused and motivated each day to do what you had to do?
I think pride in doing a good job, and also I was able to learn more Chinese all the time, because most of our soldiers didn't know any English or American at all. And so we had to learn enough of it to know when to pop some explosives. And they would count down, and they'd count down in Chinese, and finally we'd get them to count down in English. And it was always fun to make sure that they would handle everything right. And then they would always mop up in case there were some Japanese that hadn't been hurt or killed with the... And if they were hurt, we just left them back in those days. We didn't take any prisoners. We didn't shoot any prisoners because we didn't take any. If they could live, get back to their base, well, fine, because we'd be a long way away. And they thought we had motorized equipment. I'm sure they thought that, but we didn't.
And working so closely with so many Chinese soldiers... And you hate to generalize, because each one of these is a different individual, but if someone said, what were those Chinese soldiers like? What's your lasting impression of these men that you served with and fought against the Japanese with? How would you answer that?
Well, I'd say that they had a great pride in being Chinese, and they were the ones that were being overrun by the Japanese back in those days. And so their pride carried them all the way. They just wanted to do the best they can for their country. And they weren't, you know, they didn't even speak the same language sometimes. You know, back in those days, you had five major dialects. And so right now, it's a law in China that you speak what they call Beijinghua, or Peking speak, which means Mandarin to us. And so they had to learn how to talk to each other as well. It was kind of mixed up for a while, and then they had to try to teach us so that we could learn what they were talking about as well. But their motivation was pride, because of their country.
Don would continue to see that pride in action even after World War II ended. We'll hear about that and more of Sacco's daring exploits when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.